Committee. Joint Committee Ways and Means Education Subcommittee to order for an informational meeting. And prior to delving into the Oregon Student Assistance Commission overview, followed by the Department of Education, Higher Education overview, I'm going to turn it over to our esteemed legislative fiscal analyst, Mr. Steve Bender, who has some important information and comments for the committee. So, Mr. Bender.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out a few things that have been distributed to you and are here in front of you this afternoon. The first is we've distributed an agenda to you for the next 2 weeks. There's also been a copy of this sent to your office, but you can see here that next week you will be having work sessions and public hearings on five agency small house health occupational licensing board agencies. In addition, I do want to point out that on Tuesday you have on the agenda a federal grant application from the Department of Education. You may not be aware of this, but the Ways and Means Committee is required under law during session, or I should say put another way, state agencies are required to receive Ways and Means approval before they apply for federal grant monies. And there is a request, such an application will be coming forward to you from the Department of Education on Tuesday. Since we're talking about this a bit, let me also mention that the Department of Higher Education and OHSU are exempt from that requirement since obtaining federal research is part of their missions. But for other agencies, they will come forward, and there is one scheduled for Tuesday. Also, some materials have been distributed to your offices. If you haven't seen these already, this is a handout from LFO. You should have five of these distributed in your office already for the five work sessions that are coming up next week. This is an LFO memo dealing with that. And you should also have the presentation materials from the Board of Dentistry. The other boards have not presented those yet. So please be on the lookout. If you can't find any of those, let us know. And the final thing I'd like to just bring to your attention before you start your other items on your agenda is we have distributed to you a table relating to the 2% co-chairs reduction exercise that they have requested the subcommittee to do. What this shows is the budgets that are subject to the 2% reduction under the co-chairs rules and the calculation of the reduction amounts, as you can see in those right three columns. What we will be, what you will be asked to do would be, assuming the ones that are here in yellow are ones that LFO is recommending that not be taken for one reason or another, and we'll go into detail on that, with those recommendations when these budgets come up. But essentially, the target would be about $138 million general fund reduction, about a $12 million in lottery funds reduction, and about a $25 million in other funds reductions in order to meet the co-chair's targets. So, again, we'll be getting into those as the budgets come through. But this gives you some idea of the magnitude of this exercise.
Okay, on that happy note, thank you, Mr. Bender. Now I'd like to turn it over to our overview of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And I hope and trust that it was articulated to you that this would be approximately 25 minutes in length. Okay, excellent. And the committee understands it, just so we're all on the same page. The idea is this is a rather broad overview, not going into extraordinary detail, and the committee members will probably refrain from asking questions until the end unless it's absolutely... No, actually, they will wait until the end to ask questions, even Senator Decker. turning it over to Dennis Johnson, the executive director. Welcome.
Thank you.
And the floor is yours.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk about something that started out, as many things do, as kind of a good idea in the 1950s. And I don't plan to spend time on history here, except that I think it is important to realize that some of these good ideas take a few years to come to fruition. Senator Mark Hatfield authored the original bill that would have created the kind of body that we are today. By 1959, Governor Hatfield then actually had bipartisan support for creating a scholarship commission, and we continue today through some roller coaster of history from the 1950s to the present. Expansion at one point to include a major state guarantee function, loan guarantee function for students. Then in 2004, contraction when the student guarantee function went away, and the commission returned to its core mission, its core function of scholarships and grants for college and university students throughout the state of Oregon. Today, we are a small, you could say modest size agency if you look at the amount of revenue that goes through our coffers. Certainly, the number of students that we impact across the state of Oregon makes us a major impact in post-secondary education. There are four main facets to the commission as we stand today. The Oregon Opportunity Grant, and you hear lots about this. We will be discussing more about this as the session goes on. It is the state's main need-based program for college and university undergraduates. In addition, though, in something that is unique in the United States, we administer more than 340 private and targeted public programs that benefit students and graduates of our post-secondary institutions. In addition, we have a program that is statewide in its reach and even more ambitious in our plans for the future, Aspire, which is statewide outreach, mentoring, working with secondary students all around the state of Oregon. And then finally, kind of our quality control function, the Office of Degree Authorization, that helps us to ensure the quality, the ongoing quality of degrees, diplomas, programs that are offered in the post-secondary arena in the state of Oregon. The Oregon Opportunity Grant, of course, is the largest of our programs, the largest state-funded program for post-secondary student assistance. It is primarily general fund. Although every biennium we have several million dollars that is federal money, there's a federal program that requires a maintenance of effort and matching, and then lottery funds which contribute to the pool that we can award to students. This program is awarded based on need only. It's important to keep that distinction. It's not a scholarship that involves an academic or a kind of special talent or ability to receive. It's based on the student's financial situation. $29.3 million distributed last year to over 24,000 students, and that was a substantial increase over the previous year, over the level of funding for the previous biennium. The students thank you, we thank you, the legislature, the legislators who were here in the last biennium made a significant investment and a significant increase in funding through this program, definitely benefited more students and contributes in the long run to Oregon's success. Projections for this year, the current 2006-2007 school year, we could hit close to $31 million. This is the first year that we have had awards to part-time students, and we have part-time students on many of Oregon's 40 college and university campuses. That includes the entire OUS system, all of the community colleges, and quite a number of private, non-profit, independent colleges. The description that you see there just tells you that we don't help all part-time students. There's a minimum of 6 credit hours that are required for assistance under this program. They must be resident undergraduates, Oregon residents, in other words. Enrolled at 2 or 4 year public or private non-profit institutions. The located and headquartered in Oregon is an important distinction, too, because we certainly have a number of institutions that fall into categories that aren't quite so clearly defined, branches of institutions located in other states, for example. Eligibility for an opportunity grant. is determined by the student's situation. That would be household size, dependency status, that kind of thing. Eligibility for the federal Pell Grant. We have a linkage to the Pell Grant program right now. And the percentage of Oregon's median family income. We have different percentages based on the student's situation. The free application for federal student aid, known as the FAFSA, is the student's free application for the grant. Students don't have to submit any other form to be considered. And every college or university in Oregon that distributes Pell Grants or any other form of federal aid has its students filling out the FAFSA. So it's a universal application. We at the commission then receive all those FAFSAs and can determine how many students would qualify for the opportunity grant. Very important reminder here at the bottom. Next up, the proposed shared responsibility model. You'll be hearing much more about this. We're extremely excited about a proposal to really expand eligibility, kind of change the way we think about need-based assistance available through this program. If successful, if this proposal becomes reality, we could be awarding 42,000 students opportunity grants by the 2008-2009 academic year. Back to some of those other scholarships and grants. I mentioned 340 or more. This is a unique model. The closest we can find is in the state of Vermont, where they have around 100 programs, but they're not a public agency the same as we are. And it's an agency that still is doing pretty active in the loan business. So we are unique in the United States in this public-private partnership, this kind of neutral body, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, that gains the confidence of private donors and at the same time is performing this public function. Over 7,000 students apply using one of the items in your packet. It's this unified or universal, whatever you call it. It's the application, the scholarship application for those 340-some funds. No cost to the student. Again, most students are going to apply this year online. Close to 70% of them will apply online. This then becomes a counseling tool that we work with all through the academic year, walking students and parents and helping educators to become mentors, to work with students to get them into the process. So they're not only considered for all that need-based assistance, but also for these OSAC scholarships. The scholarship and financial aid application require quite a bit of help or getting into the process. So we have training and application completion workshops statewide. Most recently, last Saturday, a program at 15 different sites throughout the state. We were instrumental in getting this program to Oregon to help students complete those free applications for federal student aid, that FAFSA form that you hear about. Over 800 families took advantage of that opportunity. That's just on one day, kind of a blitz effort to get lots of people into the process. More on our scholarships and grants, the 340 again and the single form, $11 million in addition to the opportunity grant now, more than $11 million distributed to over 3,400 students. And if you just did the math in your head, 7,000 apply, 3,400 receive assistance. That's extraordinarily high compared to any other scholarship or grant program throughout the country. We're matching up students with assistance at a better rate than almost any other scholarship fund. And an awful lot of that is due to our unique partnerships with, as you see, the Oregon Community Foundation. Couldn't do it without them. We have many of our funds invested with them, and we administer and help them to select students for many of the other funds. The Ford Family Foundation, probably our single biggest partner, the largest volume of private scholarships in the state of Oregon. And then you see other institutions, and these are just a sampling of the many that we work with throughout Oregon. I mentioned how unique that is. In addition, though, several targeted programs. The Robert C. Byrd Federal Honor Scholarship is one of the most prestigious and goes to the top students in each U.S. congressional district in Oregon. We administer that each year. Funds for former foster youth, for veterans who would like to return and get into teaching, for rural health professionals or people who are going to work in sometimes remote communities where there is no professional and there's an incentive to get that service locally. Nursing services, Jobs Plus, you hear about this program, former trainees, individual education accounts, targeted funds, in other words, to meet special needs in the marketplace as well as for the students. I mentioned briefly the Aspire program. We had a hearing on this yesterday because there is a proposal to expand this statewide. Basically, what we do right now is provide mentoring resources to help students access education and training beyond high school. The mentoring that we do may take the form that it did last Saturday at the College Goal Oregon workshops around 15 sites where we actually help people fill out forms. It may take the form of an advisor working with a student to try to clarify college goals and how best to reach those goals, educational planning, that kind of thing. Whatever form it takes, the overall goal here is to build a sustainable community of volunteers in each community where we work. We're now in more than 80 communities or 80 high schools throughout the state of Oregon, and the proposal that you'll be hearing about in the session would expand that to 150 altogether. We think that's a very attainable goal. We have a model that has been tested, and if you look at our statistics, I think you can say this is no small effort with 1,000 volunteers serving in more than 80 of those schools right now. 6,000 students matched one-on-one with these mentors, but beyond that, I use language like creating a culture of achievement in a high school. What we're doing is involving the whole high school and sometimes the whole community in this effort. Our programs, the workshops, the information sessions that we run attract the involvement of more than 26,000 students. So this proposal to expand to 150 high schools, you can multiply the impact. It could be thousands more students. It's hard not to look at a map like I'm presenting and not look for communities that you know are familiar with, that kind of thing. Please remember that the communities we're working with right now are the ones who applied to participate in the program and the ones that we selected. We can't select all the high schools each year, but the ones that seem to be at a point of readiness. They have someone that they can identify who's willing to take on this challenge of becoming trained and coordinating volunteers, and that's no small task, coordinating the work of volunteers and matching those trained mentors with the students. So we would love to see another 70 or more stars on this map over the next 2 years. I mentioned briefly our quality control efforts, the Office of Degree Authorization. It's really basically part of our operation that ensures the quality of Oregon post-secondary education in three different ways. First of all, by evaluating degree programs at private and non-Oregon-based colleges. So if someone wants to come into Oregon and operate an educational program, they have to meet certain standards that are in statute that we ensure are enforced. It also protects citizens and employers from fraudulent degrees and credentials. And I'm hoping you've got a little magnet that says don't get fleeced. That's just an example of our promotional efforts. And we don't pay for that, by the way. A private sponsor paid for that. But attention-getting device that basically helps remind people that there are a lot of scams out there. The third way that the Office of Degree Authorization works to protect quality in Oregon is to prevent unnecessary use of public funds to duplicate existing programs. So it's mostly a negotiation process, making sure that all parties involved and that all competitive factors are considered when new programs are started across the state of Oregon. In the fairly near future here, what we expect to see for students. We expect to continue our collaborative efforts. We're working in special areas right now. to expand services for foster youth, streamlining the application procedures for federal funds, special funds that are meant to assist foster students. If you think of a foster youth, you're thinking of someone who is probably in the most vulnerable position of all in terms of college and university planning. Unless there is help, unless there is a streamlined procedure, many of these students fall through the cracks. We have a proposal, and we're working with the Department of Human Services to move a student child care program to our commission so that we will have, we hope in coming years, student child care grants for students who have dependent children. They need child care to be able to continue post-secondary education. We're working on other programs for returning veterans. And in each of these cases, we end up working with other agencies, other parts of state government, certainly with educational institutions all around the state. New partnerships expand our financial aid outreach and education efforts, and the most recent of those is the College Goal Oregon program. The Blitz application and advising effort from last Saturday. For donors, this is a very unique opportunity for us to leverage state dollars and attract private dollars, and we do that with by showing the donors on this application what we can do for them, how we can help them select, how we can help them reach the best candidates. And it's hard not to look through an application like that and check out programs you're familiar with, career areas, geographic areas, what is targeted to high schools in different parts of the state, and how do we work with those different organizations. Each one certainly is a committee. It's an effort sometimes of local donors, sometimes pooled efforts to come up with those scholarship funds. I'm using a technical term here, non-cognitive variables in scholarship selection, but to give you just a brief summary of what we're doing, sometimes donors are after students with characteristics that are not best measured by test scores, high school grades, high school rank, that kind of thing. They're looking for the hidden gems. They're looking for leadership potential or for a student who maybe didn't have the opportunity to spend all the time that should have been spent in high school on getting good grades. Sometimes students had to work their way through high school. Some of our donors are looking for things, in other words, not readily measured by traditional means. So non-cognitive variables help us through the use of short answer questions to focus in, to zone in, or hone in, if you will, on what potential an individual candidate has. And it's a very well recognized procedure or process or development across the country. We figure if it's good enough for the Gates Foundation, it's probably good enough for OSAC, so we're using some of the same kinds of ideas. For colleges and universities, one last thing I thought was worth mentioning here in terms of expanding services. A number of our colleges and universities now exchange information through a mechanism called our Oregon Financial Aid Exchange, or OFEX program. It facilitates dual enrollments by making sure that the credits a student takes at a home institution where she or he gets a financial aid award and the ones that are taken at a host institution, maybe hundreds of miles away, all those credits can be put together, packaged into a financial aid award, and that removes geographic barriers for the students. It helps technical courses. We're working with the State Nursing Association to be able to do this for nurses, for example, and it's easy to understand. Not all of those technical courses can be offered everywhere in Oregon, but through our exchange program, and again, we're just the neutral facilitator of this thing. Through this program, it makes those dual enrollments possible. Very cognizant of the time, but I wanted to have you hear just a little bit about some of the challenges that we face and how we respond to those. First of all, measuring the data, measuring our performance. Nothing could be more important at the end of the day. Are we worth investing in, and are these services worth continuing? Well, sometimes you need outcomes data that isn't readily available from the kind of databases we work with. We work with students at the front end of the process, at the application and financing end of the college search and selection process. So we don't have all the data we need to find out what happened to those students years later. We've negotiated data exchange agreements with the Oregon University system, with the community college system. By implication, we can go further and work with other areas in state government, but we want to be able to tell what happens to opportunity grant recipients years after they get a grant through the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. Similarly, we've negotiated a contract, and we get very favorable rates with the National Student Clearinghouse, and that is a way of our telling what happens to students who completed and fell off the radar on some campus. Did they take courses later somewhere else? Did they go to work? What did they do? This helps us to track those students longitudinally. In terms of the agency itself, we're concerned with building capacity. We're currently partnering with the Oregon University system to develop a program that will enable us to implement the shared responsibility model, a different way of awarding opportunity grants should that proposal become reality later in the session. We are partnering with our state loan guarantor. We're no longer in the business, but we've gotten the guarantor who is in the business to fund most of the colorful packet that you have. Inside the front cover, it says Oregon Opportunities. This is an Oregon-specific booklet. The overall booklet is a worksheet, a tool, a description of the financial aid process. It's one of the tools that we use to work with counseling those 25,000 students or more throughout the state of Oregon. We can't afford this. It isn't in our budget. If we did this, it would be on much cheaper paper with lower production values. But working with those partners, we can get quality materials that do the job that we expect for the state of Oregon. Similarly, the College Goal Oregon program. That is only possible because of a $150,000 three-year grant that we received from an outside foundation. So what you're looking at when you look at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission is not just the small group of people and the many students that we help, but partners all over the country that we bring to the table to help with this task. Back at our office, the appropriate staffing. We've been at this for about a year now, at least I have been as executive director. We've been looking at each job function very, very carefully and found something that we didn't really expect to find. We didn't need one of our management positions. We converted it to something else. Similarly, what I've identified that needed work immediately was that our staff, we don't have a lot of them, but they're very focused on their individual assignments, and that is a vulnerability in some ways. It's great to have focused, talented, bright, committed people, but if you're missing one, you have a deficit. With cross-training, we can handle those short-term deficits, if you will. So those are things that we're working on that don't show up all the time in performance measures. Things that have to do with the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the Shared Responsibility Model, those will show up in future years. But the agreements that we put in place, the data that we're gathering, the systems that we're building, and the staff that we're training will make possible greater impact in the future.
Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, Mr. Johnson, for that fine presentation. Very much appreciative. I believe you said that the Robert C. Byrd Scholarship.
Yes.
In each congressional district, there's a recipient.
Yes.
You have to hand it to Senator Byrd. Not only does he do well for West Virginia, but in each, that's fascinating. Great. So, anyway, are there any questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has to do with the Office of Degree Authorization, and my question would be: to what extent is it duplicative of the Northwest Association for Accrediting Colleges and Universities?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I'd like to have the head of our office, our director, this is Alan Contreras, address the question for me. He can speak more directly because it's his day-to-day job, so if it's okay.
As long as Mr. Contreras agrees to state his name, and that would be fine.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, pardon me, I'm Alan Contreras, Administrator of the Office of Degree Authorization. When the legislature set up ODA in its current form in 1997, it addressed that issue very directly. What the legislature did was to exempt all the OUS institutions because they are administered by the Board of Higher Ed, exempt the community colleges because they are administered by the Board of Education, and you also exempted all of the Oregon-based Northwest accredited institutions such as Willamette, Reed, Lewis, and Clark on grounds that they were accredited by Northwest. And what you did at that time was you included a clause saying that in the event that the Northwest Association declines to arbitrate a student complaint against any one of those institutions, that complaint could come to our office, which none of which has happened since I've been here in 1999. So what we work with is mainly schools that are based in other states, schools that don't have regional accreditation and therefore require additional state oversight, or brand new startup schools that don't have accreditation at all, such as the Great Books College called Gutenberg in Eugene that ran under our authority for 9 years and finally got its accreditation last year. So we handle all of those other things. And that's how you guys set it up in 97.
Thank you. That's very limited. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment on the opportunity grants. I think that there is a great deal of interest by the members of this committee on the shared responsibility model, and a lot of us have angst over the amount of money that was turned back that reverted to the general fund at the end of the biennium that we allocated last time to opportunity grants. $13 million, I believe, is the neighborhood of the amount of money that came back. The discussions that we had around the allocation for the opportunity grant in the last session were that that money would be fully utilized, and so I think there are a lot of questions, and I think that we would greatly benefit from a pretty numbers-based, statistical-based discussion about why that reversion took place, what happened, that the awards didn't keep up with the expectations for them, and how the shared responsibility model is going to be a better way to get that money out there, and then what the accountability is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, we are anxious to get the story out about that underutilization. It's the kind of thing that doesn't have one simple answer, but the most direct response is that in previous biennia, my understanding, I wasn't here, but my understanding is that the commission used to be able to make mid-course adjustments, and by that I mean awards are limited to 11% of total cost, so you can increase the size of all awards by just going up to 12%, for example. An original goal was to reach 15% of college costs. These are on standardized budgets at schools around the state. That's one way. Another way is that for each type of student, for example...
Mr. Chair, I would hesitate to get into a detailed discussion at this point because of the time constraints, but I think that when we're in your budget presentation, that that's an area that there's going to be a great deal of interest in.
Okay. I would be happy to. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morgan, the only point I was trying to make is that the other adjustment is the percentage of median family income. When we can't adjust either of those, we are at the mercy of enrollments in the schools. A budget note in the last budget precluded the commission from making any mid-course corrections. So we had to go with only the students and only the requirements that we had. Community college enrollment, you may have heard, has been off a little bit. The projections were generous, and I think it's better to have the problem of too much funding than to have underfunded students. They knew what to expect. The financial aid offices knew, but the projections were too generous. The budget note prevented the commission from making any adjustments, and the funds are underutilized.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, and just a follow to begin with, and a question on Representative Morgan's question. Just as you, when you come back, for me, we'll need a little more detailed discussion of that and explanation of her question. And the question, though, that I have is, have you been doing any tracking of the student clearinghouse, tracking of students in this National Student Clearinghouse to be able to give us any meaningful data regarding the effect or impact of the student the cost benefit or the benefit from two students with the student opportunity grants?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I wish I could say we have all kinds of data that will answer all these questions. We're developing, we're gathering the data. There are not many pieces of information that will help with cause and effect right now, or determining that, yes, getting a larger grant this biennium than in previous years had the effect of increasing persistence or completion for some students. We're in the process of gathering the information. We're working on it. For community college programs, we're looking at students who complete within 3 years of enrolling and getting the first grant. For undergraduates at four-year schools, we're looking at a six-year time frame, completing a four-year degree, in other words, within 6 years. So it will be some time before we have exact data, but we're gathering, and we will have preliminary data through the rest of this year.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Senator Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I don't actually want to repeat myself from yesterday about this issue when it came up, but I do think that there are some items that in that discussion that I want to have brought back into the discussion, and when you come back during the budget process. One of those being that our primary emphasis was trying to ensure that any student that applied actually received the grant. So that was our primary emphasis. The other, and that we restricted you from doing those other things because of those, that primary emphasis, because we wanted to ensure that you had the funds. Two, that we had new programs that we had never had before in terms of part-time. Three, that students, it's hard to communicate to that many people, and students were familiar with the former system in which if they did not apply in time, there simply would not be any money, and when you ran out of money, you ran out of grants. Mm-hmm. And the fourth one, which I should comment on in terms of our resolution, is that we made this decision in about late July, early August in that particular year, which meant most students had long ago applied for the grants. Most students had long ago either given up that they would get them or not get them, and that we lost much of that year in terms of full utilization because of that, although they could have come back in later terms. So I think there are some things, but I think one of the things we should think about, and I'm not trying to estimate it low. Keep in mind, I'm not trying to estimate the number low, but if we go to the shared model, we should look much very closely at what that model costs, because it is going to be a significant increase, but we should not, we should probably not use a conservative or a liberal estimate. We should use something in the middle. And if we want to actually be safe, and I hope they don't cringe at this, we should set aside some of that money, not have it being available to them, and either have it available to them in the special session that will occur next February or in the e-board, so we can make that kind of adjustment. But I think there, it is very difficult to change programs drastically and expect that people will fully utilize them. I just think that there are a lot of factors here that we need to take into consideration, and I can recognize, I think one of the things that's, and I'm going on editorial here, Mr. Chairman, but one of the things that I can understand where Representative Morgan is coming from, because when you're sitting in this seat or you're sitting in another seat, you're having to make a lot of cuts and a lot of budgets that have a lot of impact on people. And if you knew that you had an additional such and such $1 million left, maybe you would have made different choices and maybe you would have been able to meet some of those needs.
If I might.
That's right. I'll represent Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do appreciate Senator Devlin's comments, and I think that part of the discussion that we need to have around this whole program is the fact that we had a discussion in the last session around the implementation of this, and we actually allocated a lower number than was originally recommended to us. We essentially misallocated $13 million that we could have made a lot better use of in some other form in the budget. And so I would hope that as we take a look at another allocation system for to try to address the same issues that we tried to address in the last session, that we are very careful and deliberative as we step through how we think it's going to work, because we have a very much higher probability of missing than we have of hitting.
We're done.
Okay. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I understand that you can't give us completion figures today, but I'm curious if students who receive grant Oregon Opportunity Grants who do not complete a four-year degree bear any responsibility to the state, financial or otherwise.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, no, it is a grant program. These are funds that do not require repayment. We do know that some students return later and complete. Students are on their own timetables sometimes, mm-hmm. and increasingly we see patterns of stopping in and stopping out. That may be perfectly logical and defensible for an individual student. So I don't have any recommendation in that regard, except that I know that grants and the availability of aid increases student enrollment. All the research, all the data shows that when we can hold the amount of indebtedness down, when we can hold the cost down, we increase access, we increase persistence, and we increase completion. If I may, one more comment. Mr. Chair, I would like to respond to a point that Senator Devlin made. I want to reassure the committee that for the second year now, no student has missed an opportunity grant because of a deadline. Those deadlines, when they went away, that really did help students to enroll, increase choice, made possible for a student to start in a winter quarter or a spring quarter, where in the past that would not have been possible. And the same thing holds for those part-time students this year. So year-round access to this need-based grant and full-time and part-time students.
Thank you very much. I see no further questions. So, Mr. Johnson, once again, thank you very much. It looks like the committee has assigned you some homework. So we look forward to seeing you in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. So next, continuing on the theme of education access opportunity, we're going to have the Department of Higher Education overview. And I have on my list that we have Donald Blair from the State Board of Higher Education, Chancellor George Pernsteiner, President Martha Andow of the Oregon Institute of Technology, and President Ed Ray from Oregon State University. And if there is anyone else who is set to come to the dais, please alert all of us. And I know you have to set up here. So while you're doing that, any committee members have any? Well, no, you look like you're
low tech.
You're ready to go. Okay, low tech. We like low tech, so please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. We certainly appreciate the opportunity to share with you some of our thinking on the future of public higher education in the state of Oregon. I also do want to acknowledge one of my fellow board members sitting in the back of the room, Mr. Tony Van Vliet. And also one of our former board members, Jeremy.
Excuse me.
You want me to introduce myself?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
My name is Don Blair. I am a member of the Oregon State Board of Higher Education.
And, appreciate that. It's also, you know, obviously it's also just
sure.
For the record, and
sure.
There are probably thousands of Oregonians
who should be working right now, but they're listening on their internet connection.
White ticket.
Yes, so we want to make sure we know.
Okay.
Please stop.
My apologies. Is there, would you like?
No, that was perfect.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, let me just speak to, I think, the overall perspective we have as a board, and we passionately believe that public higher education is vital for the economic, social, and political health of the state, and in fact, of the United States. The benefits of post-secondary education have been clearly documented. The statistics indicate that college graduates earn more money, pay more taxes, use fewer state services, and participate more in volunteer and political activities. The benefits to the state and the nation, I think, are equally clear. In today's global economy, states and nations with a highly educated citizenry will enjoy a higher standard of living and greater freedom than those whose students are, or whose citizens are less well prepared to compete in a knowledge economy. The Oregon Employment Department estimates that over the next 10 years, nearly 80% of high-wage jobs in the state of Oregon will require at least a bachelor's degree. And the reality is that if we cannot educate Oregonians to fill those positions, that those jobs will either go elsewhere, and Oregon will not have the services and not produce the products that could have been provided, or those high-paying and rewarding jobs will go to those who were born to privilege or who were educated in other states or other countries. Governor Kulongoski appointed many of the current members of the board in 2004. So at this point, we know just enough to be very dangerous. But we recognized very early on, as did the governor, that we needed to change how we approached higher education. We could not continue the way we had been going. The Oregon University system has great strengths, both in its individual institutions and in its central leadership. But declining financial support from the state and the lack of flexibility in deploying those financial resources we do have makes the system very difficult to operate and has put the system into crisis. Unfortunately, we are still in that crisis situation. Most of our institutions are still struggling to balance their budgets and also provide a quality education to the citizens of Oregon who are eager for that opportunity. To climb out of the hole that we're in, we needed a map. And our strategic plan was intended to provide that map. The plan needed to focus on both our aspirations for the future as well as being realistic about where we were now and what we were starting with. What I'm going to do in the remainder of my remarks is describe to you our strategic plan and how we got there. And I believe that you're going to receive a handout of a summary of that plan, a two-page summary of the plan. Okay, you've got it. Great. The key elements of the plan are goals, what we're trying to achieve, guiding principles for system governance and operations, and then strategic priorities for the next 5 to 20 years. We began by outlining what it was that we were trying to achieve, and those were our goals for higher education in Oregon. And we tied our performance measures, our strategic priorities, and our budget requests to those goals. Our four goals are, first, to create in Oregon an educated citizenry, to support responsible roles in a democratic society, and provide a globally competitive workforce to drive the state's economy, while ensuring access for all qualified Oregonians to quality post-secondary education. The second goal was to ensure high-quality student learning leading to subsequent student success. The third goal, to create original knowledge and advance innovation. And fourth, to contribute positively to the economic, civic, and cultural life of communities in all regions of Oregon. We then outlined how the system should work towards those goals. These are our guiding principles for system governance and operations. The first guiding principle was that we wanted to take a portfolio approach. We are composed of 7 unique institutions, and what we were looking for was a system that operated in a decentralized way,
because we believe that the institutions can best respond to the needs and capabilities of their faculties, their students, and their communities. But at the same time, we were seeking a system that was integrated within an overall system and a framework of strategies to maximize the efficiency and the effectiveness for the state as a whole. So essentially trying to create a system that is both nimble and responsive to local concerns and unique capabilities of each institution, but also operating within an integrated framework as a system. Some of the key elements of that portfolio approach: a shared accountability model between the center and the individual institutions, which requires clear goals and strategies for each institution that align to the goals of the overall system. The way that we approach that is that the board approves campus missions, certain campus performance goals, tuition requests, capital projects, and we evaluate the performance of each one of those institutions and the performance of the presidents. So essentially the board and the central office are really trying to set overall guardrails and goals for the individual institution so that we can operate as an integrated system without micromanaging the individual institutions. Second key element of operating a decentralized portfolio of institutions is setting up appropriate performance measures. And the Oregon University system has tracked and measured performance since 1997, and every investment that we make includes measures that track the returns for Oregon. And I think you also have a handout of the performance measurements that we use as a system. We've also spent quite a bit of time on our financial oversight of the individual institutions. We review financial reports at the institution level on a quarterly basis at the board level, and then the staff, the chancellor's staff, actually looks at financial reporting for each of the institutions on a monthly basis. We've also put quite a bit of resource into strengthening our internal audit function to ensure that in a decentralized environment, we are doing our best to make sure that the resources that you entrust to us are used effectively. The second guiding principle was that we needed to create an adequate and sustainable financial structure for the long-term of the system, long-term health of the system. Really, two key elements I want to call out here. Number one is that we believe that it's absolutely imperative that we halt the 15-year disinvestment in higher education. In our view, there is really no substitute for additional resources from the state. With that said, we also challenged ourselves in the strategic planning process not to assume that the solution to all of the financial issues was going to come from a bigger check from the state or bigger checks from students. Our focus was really to look for bold and creative steps to help us use our resources more effectively and to ensure that we were doing things as efficiently as we could within the construct of the system. Our third guiding principle was that we wanted to make sure that in the service of the second principle, a long-term financial structure that was sustainable, we wanted to make sure that we were as operationally and financially flexible as possible. It's vital to make sure that we release the creativity and the entrepreneurial abilities of our public employees and our faculty as we try to deliver quality education to our students. In my own experience, it's very difficult to set priorities in a budgeting process. I can only imagine what you must go through. I have to say, you have far more constituencies to deal with than we do at Nike. One of the things I also believe is that the more constraints you have on those prioritization decisions, the more difficult it is. And certainly as I've worked in this higher education arena for the last 3 years, the number of constraints on decision making in the system are certainly much, much higher than I would experience in a corporate environment. And that certainly makes this prioritization very, very difficult. We also need to have the flexibility to redeploy savings when we do find them. And I think that's something that we certainly had some conversation with a couple of members of the committee at one of our recent board meetings, and I know that the senators who were present are very passionate about finding new ways to operate and new ways to be more efficient and more effective. One of the things that I think is very important is to provide the incentive for the agencies to be able to find places to save money in order to invest in their missions, and that's really one of the things that we think is important for the university system. The last guiding principle was a recognition that we needed to create an integrated educational system in the state. This is something that the governor has spoken about quite a bit, but perspective that I have based on relatively limited experience here, but I think very, very powerful, is that the world has changed since I graduated from university quite a few years ago. I think students are increasingly reaching out to different places for their post-secondary education, whether it be combinations of community college education, four-year universities, online distance learning, sometimes courses taken in high school. There's certainly a much more diverse educational enterprise, and we needed to integrate very closely with both the pre-K through 12 organizations as well as the community colleges, and we believe that was an important part of our strategy. So I've outlined the goals and where it is that we thought our guiding principles needed to be. Those are the guardrails on the road to the goals. Our strategic priorities represented the action steps we thought we needed to take in order to make progress against the goals. And there were really three broad areas. Number one, increase student educational attainment. Number two, invest in globally competitive research, finding places where we could create competitive advantage for Oregon. And number three, to make sure that we assure the long-term financial viability of the system. And in our strategic planning documents, we have some fairly detailed description of some of the initiatives underway in those three action areas. So with that as an overall outline of our strategic planning process, I'd like to turn it over to George Bernsteiner, the Chancellor of the Oregon University System.
Thank you, Don. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, George Bernsteiner, Chancellor of the University System, thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to showcase a little bit about who we are and where we're going and why that's important for Oregon. Director Blair mentioned to you the importance of higher levels of educational attainment in an increasingly global society and economy. To sort of underscore that, I had the opportunity earlier this week to be in a meeting with the chairman of Intel, where he said in no uncertain terms that the prosperity and the success of a nation's economy, any nation's economy in the 21st century, will be directly related to its level of educational attainment. And he had lots of examples from other countries about what they were doing and why Intel viewed that as important and why Intel viewed that as meaning that those nations were on an upward trajectory in the 21st century in terms of their relative position for their economy and the success of their nations. But I call to your attention something some of you have already seen, which is the educational attainment brief that's in your packet. And you'll see there that in the United States, the educational attainment of younger adults in the workforce is approximately the same as that for older adults in the workforce. We are a, quote, mature economy. However, for Oregon, the younger adults, the people who will be replacing those of us who've been around a while, in the aggregate have a lower level of education than do the older members of the workforce. In a 21st century economy where educational attainment is the key to the success of a state or a nation, that is probably the wrong situation to be in. And part of the request that we have before you, that you will be taking up over the course of the next several months, is to allow the state to join us in an investment that will increase the educational attainment of Oregonians. Educational attainment at the high school graduation level, at the community college, associate and apprentice level, at the university level, and bachelor's, master's, doctorates, and professional degrees. A strong PK-20 education system will yield the highly skilled workforce that we will need to ensure a strong, sustainable, successful Oregon economy and society in the 21st century. We have 7 campuses, as Don indicated, in the Oregon University system, and each of them is a little bit different from the other one. You know all of them, probably, but let me just sort of review the bidding for you a minute. The University of Oregon in Eugene is a liberal arts and sciences, AAU, research-oriented university with certain professional programs like law, architecture, and journalism. It serves those particular functions and serves them very well. Oregon State University, and Ed Ray will be joining me at the table fairly soon, is our land-grant institution, which means it has a statewide scope of service. It has a focus on agriculture, science, engineering, forestry, veterinary medicine, pharmacy, and also has the largest research portfolio of any of the institutions in the state. Portland State University has the largest enrollment in the state. It's a comprehensive urban university with its research and its programs focused largely on the needs of Oregon and the metropolitan area of Portland. Western Oregon University, which is the closest to Salem, started as an education school. It still has a very fine, one of the best education schools around, and has a good focus on liberal arts. Southern Oregon University is one of our regional campuses, which focuses on meeting the needs of the counties around it that it serves. In addition to that, it has a very fine performing arts, fine arts program. Eastern Oregon University, again, serves a very large region, but also has taken on the role of having the biggest distance education programs in the state. And, of course, Oregon Institute of Technology, and Martha Ann Dow will be joining me, has focused on technology and healthcare workforce programs. So each of them is a little bit different from the other. And I think that's important when you think about the portfolio of the institutions in meeting the overall needs of the state. We serve this fall more than 81,000 students. It's the highest ever. Record enrollment. 14% of those students were students of color. Highest proportion ever. 4,000 of those students came to us from other countries. The most ever. 66,000 students are undergraduates, 15,000 are graduates. About 75% of our students attend full-time. About 75% are also from Oregon, and about 20% transfer to OUS from Oregon community colleges. It gives you sort of an indication of where our students come from and what they focus on in terms of full-time and part-time. We awarded last year more than 19,000 degrees and certificates. Again, the highest number ever. More than one-third of our degrees were in health professions, sciences, math, engineering, and teacher education. All of them areas that have been identified as being related to workforce shortage areas in this state that are either current or expected in the next few years. We have more than 2,500 full-time faculty. This is about the same as it was in the mid-1990s. It's higher than it was 2 years ago. That's good. But our enrollment today is 20,000 students more than it was in the mid-1990s. So the same level of faculty employment is essentially serving about 20,000 students more than was the case about a dozen years ago. But interestingly also, that number of faculty are generating well over $300 million a year in externally funded research, making them some of the most productive faculty on a faculty-by-faculty, you know, member-by-member ratio in the country. Many of them are internationally and nationally recognized. They're leading experts in many fields. Professor Richmond, who was in the back row, may still be, since I don't have eyes in the back of my head, is internationally recognized in chemistry. We have some of the top faculty in the world in our universities. And they are recognized as such because they are successful in getting peer-reviewed awards for their leading-edge research. It's important to remember that we provide that function in Oregon as well. The statewide public services, the Agriculture Experiment Station, the Oregon State Extension Service, which has offices in 35 counties, the Forest Research Lab. Those are all things that OSU does as part of its statewide mission as the land-grant university. Campus public services, from the Labor Education Research Center at the University of Oregon, to the Veterinary Clinic at Oregon State, to the Population Research Center at Portland State, and many, many others that you don't often think about when you think about universities, but those are direct services that affect individuals in this state, or are affecting the state as a whole. We have been very successful in the last few years. Our enrollment is up, the number of degrees is up, our retention rates are higher than they used to be, our time to graduation is lower than it used to be. That's a good thing. But there are some challenges that we face, and we're beginning to see some erosion of some of the improvement that we've been able to tout before you for the last several years. A decreasing proportion of last year's high school graduating class went on to the university. In fact, many didn't go at all. Some went out of state. We have a situation in which a student is only about half as likely in a rural area to go on to the university than from a metropolitan area. So that we don't have even distribution of participation around the state at a time that we're saying and meaning that educational attainment is the key to success in the 21st century. That's a problem. Faculty salaries are an issue for us because although we have a very successful faculty in both instruction and research and in service, they are paid at levels that are near the bottom of their peer groups nationally, which makes it difficult to attract new faculty and to retain some of those that we have. And that's been proven out by the difficulty we've had in some of our searches, which have not produced, which have not been successful in many cases in the past few years. Our student-faculty ratios are among the highest in our peer groups, and that will affect student learning and affect retention and affect student success. We have been on a trajectory for the last several years in which every year every institution graduated more students than it ever had graduated before. This year that wasn't true. System as a whole, we still did. But some of the campuses began to see that their graduating class of 2006 was a little bit smaller than the graduating class of 2005. That is a harbinger of what may occur as we move forward, due to the flattening of enrollment and the difficulty of students that students are having in coming to the universities. So the investment that you made in 1999 that resulted in a big influx of students, most of those students have now graduated. That statement of hope and opportunity which you provided in 1999 and led to a huge increase in access and enrollment in the state, those students have now moved through the system. The students who will be coming now have not had that statement of hope and opportunity before. We have, as many of you know, a deferred maintenance backlog of about $650 million, and we have very financially fragile campuses. We're going to spend down about $23 million this year from fund balances. As many of you know, the appropriation support per student in Oregon is 46th in the country. We have just announced this week reductions at Southern Oregon University in programs that are very painful, very difficult, and signal that the financial condition of that campus and several of the other campuses. Many of the campuses will be making reductions this year going into next. That will continue to erode the services which they can provide to students. The key to Oregon's success is more Oregonians participating and succeeding in higher education. receiving their degrees. Achieving this, the board has come up with, for achieving this, the board came up with a three-pronged approach. The first, as Director Blair indicated, was alignment and partnership with other educational sectors in Oregon, focusing on what works in order to help students increase their preparation for and success in and completion of post-secondary education. Partnering with K-14, partnering with the high schools, partnering with the community colleges in order to make it easier, more predictable, clearer, and more understandable for students to receive college degrees. And we can go through all of the improvements that we have made in the last couple of years, but we'll save that for another time. But that is part of the strategy, is to do it in partnership with K-12 and the community colleges. The second is to make investments that will yield high returns for the state in the future. The director of the Student Assistance Commission spoke briefly about one aspect of that, which was the shared responsibility model. The focus on affordability for students is very important, because if a student can't afford to go to college, we will not, in fact, achieve the level of education that is needed for the state and its economy. The shared responsibility model, if approved by the legislature, will send a signal to Oregonians that if they work, if their families contribute, if they take advantage of federal financial aid, that in fact the state will help them to be able to attend and succeed in post-secondary education. But that, by itself, does not solve the affordability issue. It has to be tied with a policy of tuition which restricts tuition growth to no more than the growth in the median family income of Oregonians. And that, in fact, is also what this budget does. So it addresses affordability. The budget also addresses regional and rural access and support by providing funding to those regional campuses. It addresses the faculty salary issue head on, because competitiveness for faculty is key to the success of the university system and of the state. It supports Oregon's workforce needs through investments in healthcare workforce, through the ETIC, and other investments. The goal, as Don indicated, was to increase student educational attainment, invest in globally competitive research, and you'll hear a lot about that in the Oregon Inc. presentations, and assure the long-term financial viability of OUS institutions and the system. The third prong, of course, is to implement the board's strategic priorities, which Don identified in the long-range plan, increasing educational attainment to assure competitive strength for Oregon and Oregonians, investing in that globally competitive research, and assuring the long-term financial viability. Sustaining and enriching system strengths, meeting the challenges faced by financially fragile institutions, and investing in globally competitive research. Those are the investments that Marvin Landau and Ed Ray will now depict.
There's a question.
Mr. Blair, before you depart, Senator Walker, you have a question?
Yeah. I have a question to the Chancellor. Chancellor, I'm going to take my SNED Education Committee down to Ashland on February 23rd, and the House Education Committee is going to join us, and any of these members are welcome to as well. We thought it was appropriate. We're going to have a public hearing on the shared responsibility model, but I also want to know what's going on down there. First, I read they're laying off 17 teaching faculty, now it's 24, now you're whacking whole programs. I mean, I know we've disinvested in higher education, but this seems like a total decimation of this university. Is there more here than what we're talking about today?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, this is very emblematic of what we're talking about today. What Southern is doing, what President Cullinan has begun to roll out, is her plan to reduce $4 million on a recurring basis from Southern's budget. It's necessitated by a combination of factors. The first is the reduction of state funding over time, and the second is a reduction of enrollment at Southern. They had a high of about 5,700 students. They're now down to just over 5,000. The campus then has to make reductions in order to bring its recurring revenues and recurring expenditures into balance. There's a several-fold plan that's being developed in order to do that. The first part of it, which the President rolled out 2 weeks ago, dealt with the administrative reductions, and that's where the 17 positions came in and layoffs came in. Those were on the administrative side, and there was about a $2.5 million reduction in support and administrative costs. The other about $1.5 million or $1.6 million to get to the $4.0 million number will come from academic programs. On Monday of this week, President Cullinan announced those areas that she is considering in her plan would be reduced or eliminated. And in that consideration are 24 faculty positions. That is now out for review by the campus and by the faculty union. Those responses from the various constituencies will come back to the President. She will discuss this matter with the board on early March, and adopt her final plan on March 5th. What it is, very directly, is that there are not enough resources at Southern in order to sustain the level of program that they currently have. And it's a very painful, very difficult set of decisions that the campus is making. At the present time, she's proposing to eliminate 3 degree programs and make reductions of faculty positions in several other programs. That's difficult. That's painful. We're trying to deal with allowing students to finish their degrees, but it does make it very difficult going forward. However, when the campus has concluded that process, the campus will be very focused in its programs, will be very focused in its approach to education, and will, in fact, be able to say, we are going to go forward being this kind of an institution, and we will be successful at that. And I think that will be a very important message to send to the Southern Oregon community, to say we are viable, we are open, we are ready for business, and here is the program mix that we think we can sustain in the long run that will allow the people of Southern Oregon to be successful. And I think that's going to be an important message that will be part of what President Cullinan will be talking about when she finalizes her plan.
Okay, I'm going to use the thank you. I appreciate it. And I appreciate the response. And because of the time parameters, and I know there are 2 more speakers, correct?
Yes.
So I'd like to call up President Ed Ray and President Martha Ann Dow from the Oregon Institute of Technology. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be able to speak with you today from home base, Klamath Falls, the land of Oregon sunshine. I know that starting out on a not positive tone is not really like what I like to do when I come to speak to the committees of the legislature.
President Mandel, if you could state your name for the record.
I'm sorry. I got carried away. President Martha Ann Dow of Oregon Institute of Technology.
Thank you very much.
The issue, I think, that you have heard from Don and the Chancellor sets up the situation that I am going to start out on not a real positive place and talk about the fragility of the regional campuses, or what I like to call the smaller campuses, which include Eastern, Western, Southern, and Oregon Institute of Technology. And even though OIT is not only based in Klamath Falls, we have a statewide mission in technology, we serve our region very importantly in many ways, not only providing the access to the students in our rural community, as Eastern and Southern and Western also do, but providing infrastructure for that community to grow and to be able to expand in economic development. Many of us in the smaller universities have very specialized programs. Some are quite costly, including OIT's emphasis in the technologies, both in engineering and health. And with that, the peaks and valleys and canyons of a budget that is not very stable really impacts us. And I will have to say it's much more valleys and canyons than it is peaks. And subsequently, what's happening that Southern is really having to exemplify is one of the areas that many of us have been before in reducing programs, very subjective to fluctuations in enrollment from things that are happening in the economy, the ability of students to continue their education with rising tuition, and just the understanding that students and families have of whether or not higher education is even possible. So this causes our enrollment to somewhat wax and wane due to these things that are going on in our own environmental scan. This has led now again to decreases in the campus fund balance as we try to continue to maintain the quality education in light of declining resources. It also changes our ability to be nimble and to meet the student and workforce needs proactively, which the state really expects us to do. I'm not going to tell you specifically about our budgets today, but just to let you know how much we appreciate your understanding of what our enterprises are impacted by. Weakened budgets directly affect our ability to provide academic counseling and support to students, which is very important to students who are at risk in terms of their own self-confidence. And this, in turn, affects our retention, our graduation rate, and our degree attainment. Our campuses are driven by the people, the faculty and staff, and all of our campuses need to recruit and retain quality faculty because that is the core of our quality educational services. Budget cuts mean fewer support systems and inability to maintain quality faculty and staff. Particularly in the technology areas, we not only compete with other institutions outside of the state, but we have to compete with the market of the business community in hiring the faculty experts that we need. Enrollment continues to challenge us. We have blips, we have ups and downs, which I have said previously is impacted by tuition, low need-based aid, and affecting rural families' ability to go to college. Rural access is an important part of the work that the regionals and OIT are about. But despite all of these challenges, the small campuses are very strong in supporting our students. We go the extra mile. We do our best. And I just have to give you one anecdote of a student who I'll call David, who came to OIT as the timber industry of which he had relied on for his livelihood was becoming less and less obvious. He came back. He was already a married student with a family and two children, and he was able to complete a four-year degree in electronics engineering technology and go to work for ESI, who had recently been attracted to our community very much because Oregon Institute of Technology was there. This was a life-transforming opportunity for this student. We have similar examples of first-time, first-generation students that are right out of high school that neither their families or themselves have the self-confidence that their student can achieve. I'll name him Nick. He came to us. It wasn't so much the challenge of lack of financial aid, family support, and some of those things were his biggest problem. It was his own self-confidence. We have the support staff to work with that student in a program called TOP, Technology Opportunities. They worked with him daily. Every other week he came in and said, I'm dropping out. And they said, no, you're not. And they made him stay, of course. And following his graduation, we have his picture on our wall, because Nick has not only gone on to graduate school at Ball State, but now has joined a major firm. And so I say to you, many of these students stay in their community, but many have built the confidence to go on into higher ed. I think the regional campuses, it is obvious, are an integral part of the economic vitality of our towns and cities. And we do attract new industries into these areas. And also, we contribute economically. For example, OIT contributes more than $70 million annually to this rural community that's gone through major transitions. I know that I cannot leave today without talking to you about the capacity in health professions that we all are building together in consortia with community colleges, with all the other universities, and with the hospital and medical industry. We have launched the Center for Health Professions and how this will help alleviate critical shortage areas in Oregon. We're expecting to increase the enrollment in the allied health programs there by 750 students in the next 5 years. We've started Wing 1. We need Wing 2, and you will see in the budget we have a request for a G-bond for $9 million to finish this center. We have already raised the match. The interesting part is that that's the community connection, not only with Klamath Falls, but with all of Oregon. And the key to the success of all of us in the smaller universities is connections and opportunities and innovation and networking. We are indeed the coin of the realm. I think that we will find that most often people trained locally are going to stay locally and will serve the rural needs for additional health care and top quality health care. And this will also add to being able to decrease the rising cost in the health areas. The key to success is partnerships and consortiums, and the regionals, the smaller universities, and OIT are very much in those partnership modes. And I thank you very much for listening about the smaller universities today.
Thank you, President Dow. So speaking of challenges, President Ray, and I promise you, President Frohnmayer had nothing to do with this, but you've got a really
narrow window.
Yes. So, and I think also there are folks who probably want to be asking some questions, so.
I will be brief. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Ed Ray, president of Oregon State University. I'm very pleased to be here with you today. I want to talk about what your investment in higher education has yielded and some of the promise that's there. John Kenneth Galbraith used to like to say that the problem with university professors is they learn to take 2 hours to make a point. So let me give you the point up front. Bottom line is that an investment in higher education is, in fact, an investment in economic development and social progress. And I want to speak to that issue and give you some examples of things that are going on and things that are in process. Any of you who were at the Oregon Leadership Summit earlier this month heard discussion about building around our commitment to sustainability and creating industry clusters. Well, I would submit we're already there, that many of the faculty and staff at Oregon's public universities are, in fact, making major contributions to the foundations that will give rise to such industry clusters, whether it's in biofuels or wind and wave power and green buildings and other areas. In fact, along those lines, I'd point out that Oregon State University is one of only six sun-grant universities in the nation with a focus on alternative fuels. I tell people that ONAMI, the Oregon Nanosciences and Microtechnologies Institute, is effectively the poster child for what you can do when universities
state and federal government and businesses come together to create new industrial possibilities. It's a collaboration of Oregon State University, University of Oregon, Portland State University, Pacific Northwest National Laboratories, and businesses including Hewlett-Packard to really harness the capabilities of faculty and staff to create new products and new market possibilities. Two possibilities I'll mention quickly. If you want to hear about them, you can. A firm called Home Dialysis Plus, which makes portable, is working on developing portable dialysis machines, and another working with biofuel microreactors, literally alternative fuel generators that could exist on individual farms and ranches and so forth. As you know, we're working with through ETIC, the Engineering Technology and Industrial Council, to create the engineers and scientists that we need for the future. That's been an incredibly effective program, and we have a request in the budget to expand on that activity. I've told people since I've come here, I'm an economist by training, that it's not smart to talk about new industries, old industries, traditional know-how. Bottom line is, if you're not using cutting-edge technology and best business practices, and whatever you do, somebody's going to eat your lunch, whether it's national or international. It doesn't matter whether you make chips, run a bank, or run a bakery. If you're not at the leading edge, somebody's going to take your business away from you. We work closely with Oregon Inc. As you know, they've proposed some new areas for signature research programs. We're very excited about that. We're working with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department to develop areas of strength in collaboration with them as well. I mentioned you need to be cutting edge in best business practices in everything you do. And just to give some examples briefly, in traditional sectors of agriculture and forestry, people are in fact using computers, GPS devices on tractors, genetic research to improve crop yields, create new crop varieties, and mitigate environmental damage. I know that Senator Morgan knows this better than most. 50 years ago, if you went to a logging producer, a mill, and asked how much of the treaty do you use, the answer was 40%. The answer now is virtually 100%. So it's traumatic changes have occurred there as well. The ability that we've had because of your investments to create new initiatives like ONAMI does have an impact on our ability to attract and retain extraordinary international faculty. We hired a new chaired professor in our chemistry department who, in fact, only came because he's affiliated with ONAMI, so he can work with colleagues at U of O and PSU and other universities as well. A fellow named Mas Subramanian. He was the head of research at DuPont Labs. He has over 200 refereed publications, has over 8,000 professional citations, and over 51 active or pending patents. People have told me literally that by virtue of hiring Mas Subramanian, the state of Oregon can argue convincingly that it has one of the leading material sciences programs in America. That was only possible because of ONAMI. The Chancellor's already talked about the level of research. In the last full year, 2005-06, collectively we brought in $317 million in grants and contracts. That almost matches what we've gotten in annual state funding in the last 3 or 4 years. A really incredible accomplishment. Obviously, we need to get our students involved in our research, and all of the universities have made a real effort at that. I tell people that our graduates are the most important contribution we make to the future, that we prepare them to compete with anybody, anywhere, and I think my colleague presidents would agree with me that those are the values that we all share, and that's what we're working toward, and we're having tremendous success. So your investment is paying off. There's a lot more we can accomplish, and the more you can help us out, I think the more you'll see for all of us to be proud of.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, President Ray, and I do apologize. I mean, all of you have spoken very articulately. We appreciate it. And just a reminder to those of you that are here and to all of you that we will be having several meetings focusing on higher education in general, so there's more to come. So I appreciate and I apologize for the truncated time. And I think we can take a couple minutes if people have brief questions. Representative Jensen, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do not expect an answer nor a great dialogue on this question this afternoon, because I know that probably is impossible in light of the time that we have, but I leave it to the higher education community as something to think about as we proceed through these hearings and looking at the budget. I think some of you are certainly aware of the fact that I have been a fairly strong advocate for the university system as well as the community college system in Oregon, and have argued often with you that you weren't asking for enough as you came here to talk to us. But Mr. Blair, when he started his conversation, or comments, excuse me, not conversation, comments to us, implied a cause and effect relationship between a college degree and higher earnings or higher income. That I've heard that. I've seen it in print. I've seen graphs and charts of that. And, you know, quite frankly, it's always kind of gnawed at me a little bit that the implication of a cause and effect relationship is there. I wonder if you might not consider that the independent variable or variables are common, that there are other independent variables that are common to both a higher earnings and an educational achievement or attainment, and that those other independent variables are such things as clear and defined goals of where they want to be and where one wants to go, are you know, such things as a work ethic, because it takes a work ethic to attain the level of education that you all have. It's not something you do just kind of automatically. Now, I mention these things and bring them up not because I'm going to you know, necessarily try to cut higher education budgets or appropriations you know, here, but because I think by not facing or not looking at possibly the other variables, we're not getting the best bang for our buck. If it is such things as work ethic, for example, that is an independent variable in becoming having a better than average income, or in being a college graduate, you know, then maybe we, and especially the education community, ought to be looking at what do we do in our society to promote those other, the strengthening of those other variables that are the causal variables for what we're looking for or what we're looking to achieve in education. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me.
Sure. Any other comments or questions? Oh, good. All right. Thank you very much, everybody. And we'll be seeing you in the not-too-distant future. And with that, I adjourn this meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you.